All right, we go. Recording in progress. So I'm going to start clicking these off as best I can. There's a lot, which is great. This is why we do it. It's kind of fun. Okay, I believe this is from Jessica. I believe you mentioned something about using psychedelics in regard to an illness you've had. Can you expand on that? I can within very limited confines because I'm not too inspired to talk about the personal aspects of this, but because of a deal us healthily health issue last year, which was interesting in timing with the release of my book, I did explore some agents. And I can tell you that for some people, me included, they can be extremely helpful. Ayahuasca, for one, I had no insights with that, but other people who do use it have what the tradition talks about as psychic surgery, where they have these types of visitations and they can have healing that takes place from these external agencies to whatever extent you believe in that. I used a different agent that helped me work with the psychogenic nature, like what perhaps may I not be seeing in relation to this balance, this dis-ease. And I found it to be extraordinarily helpful. So there's quite an extensive literature on this already. I'm a little bit reluctant to expand personally on that for a number of reasons. But I can tell you in my case, it was extraordinarily helpful. And so if you have resonance with these sorts of things, set and setting is super important. Doing it absolutely in a non-recreational capacity under the guidance of a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapist. I actually flew in a PhD researcher, friend of mine, kind of a shaman person, who was extraordinarily helpful. Without that, I wouldn't really particularly endorse these things, but with them, I think this can be a game changer. Okay, from the Buddhist perspective, this is from Jawad. I think that's Jawad. Please excuse me if I don't pronounce these names properly. From the Buddhist perspective, why do some people remember their dreams vividly every night and some don't? Is it a karmic thing, lifestyle thing, or subconscious programming? Yes, all the above. It's multifactorial, it's systemic. And so, from a Buddhist perspective, it has to do with the way the channels are configured. We all have a very subtle, complex, subtle body anatomy and physiology. And certain predispositions slash talents and whatnot are actually conjoined with the way the software is structured. Also has to do, is it a karmic thing? For sure, in that regard, because the way your channels are configured is due to karma. Buddhist lifestyle thing, for sure. I mean, the biggest reason, really, the biggest reason you don't remember your dreams, let alone become lucid in them, is because we're unaware of the contents of our mind during the day. It's like Kabir said of death, what is found now is found then, or what is not found now is not found then. So lifestyle has a huge aspect to this. Subconscious programming, unconscious programming, for sure. That one as well. There's part of you and your spectrum of your identity that may be interested in remembering dreams and becoming lucid, but there's often a conflict of interest on different bandwidth, the devolutionary aspect of the spectrum of your being that wants nothing to do with this. And so, therefore, this internal conflict of interest. Probably the most important thing here is that you can change this using principles of neuroplasticity, nadi plasticity, changing the patterns and structures of your subtle body. Your subtle body is plastic, just like your brain is plastic. You can change it through dream yoga, through recitation of mantra, through inner yoga practices. You can totally change it. So, I would say the big take-home message here is you can positively, absolutely increase dream recall using a ton of techniques, which is written about extensively in the literature and also in my book, Dream Yoga, and my Lucid Dreaming Handbook. I write extensively about this as well. But in terms of Buddhist perspectives on dream recall, it's all the above. It's a dependently originated systemic condition. Okay, so I'm going to spin around because there's a bunch here. I want to get to some of the shorter ones first. Okay. All right, from Karen, and as early as 2005, study results were published that suggested increased mortality with galantamine in patients suffering from mild dementia. How is this to be classified? I have no idea what you mean by that. How is this to be classified? That I just don't know what you mean by that. So if you're here and can explain that part of the question, I can address it. I don't know what that means. The rest of it I can't address. As lucid dreamers, do we need to stay away from galantamine? Depends on you. These studies, again, I don't remember this one particularly. I pinged out a note to one of my neuroscientist friends to see what the latest word on this, but I can tell you one thing for sure. There's a big difference between over-the-counter galantamine, which is prescribed for lucid dreaming at super low doses with low duration. And, you know, dosage and duration are huge. 4 to 8 milligrams max every, you know, 2-3 days max or even a week, as opposed to prescription strength riazidine, where you can have up to 32 milligrams a day. I mean, what is that? 4 or 5 times higher every single day? So it's a dosage duration issue. Anything, and I wouldn't, you know, using the word excess is idiosyncratic, so it depends. Anything can become problematic. In relationship to lucid dreaming, first of all, you're using dosages that are a fraction of that, and you're not using nearly the duration of that. So I know of very, very few deleterious side effects with over-the-counter galantamine as it's used properly for lucid dreaming. I bet any money you're talking about, because otherwise they wouldn't be studying it at these low doses. They're studying prescription strength, which is a heck of a lot higher. The rest of the question, Karen, I just don't understand. So if you're here and want to come on and clarify it for me, I'll take a crack at it. Okay. This one is from Damien. Hi, Andrew, Mr. Holacek. I'm interested in Buddhism and the enlightenment process. Okay, that's a good thing. I'll run some commentary because some of these questions are long, and I'll just run commentary as I go through it. Damien, you're already enlightened. You're already enlightened. You just have to recognize it. But I do understand your question in terms of a process. Back to you. I came across your material, and this is something that I would like to further explore. Good for you. I'd like to ask for guidance. Could you recommend me a Buddhist teacher who would be available online for private intense teaching on dream yoga and enlightenment? Unfortunately, I don't know anybody who could do this. The best that I can do is Nightclub. That's why we started Nightclub, was specifically for this reason, where people like you could explore the nocturnal meditations in a community with support. So the best I can do, Damien, is direct you to Nightclub, where we have 3, 4, or 5 events a week that you can participate in. You get a lot of support there. Finding someone who can do one-on-one with you, I don't know anybody who could do this, unfortunately. You continue, especially in the Jonang and Kagyu tradition. Yeah, Jonang turned into Shentong, so that's a really great tradition. Especially Jonang Kagyu tradition are of interest here. Good for you. That's a wonderful set of traditions that are worth being interested in. I know that such persons are hard to find, yes, and getting in contact is initially rather difficult. Yes, it is. I hope that my question does not cause any inconvenience, not at all. In terms of the guidance here, what I just recommended is probably your best crack. Attending live events that either myself, Charlie Morley, Tenzin Wangyal, B.L.M. Wallace, Claire Johnson, those are the people I recommend unconditionally. Having a personal connection with them at one of their retreats, one of my retreats, is a great way to go. If you're looking for something deeper, Jonang Kagyu, then, you know, you might want to explore a number of traditions. Pulang Rinpoche's Nalanda Bodhi is fantastic. Mingjo Rinpoche's Tergar is great. Tsogyen Rinpoche's Pundarika organization is superb. So they will periodically ping a little bit on dream yoga, but there's no teacher that I know of, with the exception of Tenzin Wangyal, and it's virtually impossible to do anything one-on-one with him because he's such a big name, he's a superstar, and he's got such a big community. Best thing you can do there is just show up at, like what I mentioned at the outset, like his Ling Mingcha dream yoga program, and then whatever he does online. I wish I could be more encouraging, Damien, but that's a really great start for you if you want to go in those directions. Okay. All right. Okay. This is from Pragna, which, so hi, Andrew. I recently found a beautiful Tanka, painting of white Tara. Cool. Good for you. That had been rolled up for 30, 40 years in a store's warehouse. I don't know how old it is. Could be 50, 100 years old. Wonderful. It's a beautiful original Tibetan. Terrific. It's just on a canvas without being mounted on silk cloth. How do I honor it properly? Is it okay to frame it instead of mounting on silk? Absolutely. You don't have to mount it on silk. You can totally frame it in glass, absolutely, positively. It doesn't really matter. if you want to honor it, the best way to honor it is with your relationship, with your attitude, by asking questions like this and just treasuring this piece of art. If you have access to a teacher who can bless it, who can either write Om Mah Om or even the Dream Yoga Mantra on the back, or actually it's not Dream Yoga, I'm sorry, the Tara Mantra, Tarita Tarituria on the back, that's great. Put it in a place, if you have like an altar, shrine or anything like that, that's a wonderful way to honor it. Are there any rituals, mantras that are required to be performed daily if you have a tanka? No, not at all. If you're using it as a practice tanka and you're doing white tara practice and you want it empowered, then yes. Then you want to get someone who's in the lineage who can actually bless it. They can do this a number of ways, either by writing on the back of it, sometimes throwing rice on it, or just using mantras to bless it. Then that could be helpful. Are there any rituals, mantras required to be performed daily if you have a tanka, or is it okay to have it as an object of art? It's totally okay to have it as an object of art. Absolutely. Just treasure it for its natural beauty. I feel there was no accident. I was led to this tanka, and in fact, it found me, and I want to honor it. That's a really sweet relationship. Good for you. Can you talk a little bit about white tara? Honestly, there are so many Indian goddesses in my tradition, so I have not felt the need to know tara, but here she is. Yeah, this is another really, really big topic. I would direct you to my friend Lama Paulden, who she's like the Tara expert. She's a rock star. She's a beautiful human being. Lama Paulden, I think she's in Portugal now. I'm not sure. She's the person to talk to on this. Google her. You will find a number of articles that she's published in relationship to this, either in Tricycle Lines Lore or Buddha Dharma magazine. You know, the Tara principle is a massive topic. It would just take too much time to talk about it. There are 21 forms of Tara associated with the 21 manifestations of the Karmapas. In the lineage of Amitabha, Chenrezi, Padmasambhava, it's in that kind of track. The Tara principle, you know, this one is white Tara is principally in contradistinction to the most famous kissing cousin of, which is green Tara. This is basically for health, healing, holistic approaches. And it's fantastic. It's a sutra level deity, Yadam. And you can gain sutra level practices, pujas that you can do in regards to her. And so if you have a connection, go for it. I mean, white Tara is just amazing, right? Just amazing. Outside of that, boy, I hate to say it, but go ask Dr. Google, because really exploring the refinements of white tara, I mean, you could do a week-long program on this, and we just don't have time. So Lama Paulden again, and then, yeah, I'm sure I didn't take the trouble to look online, but white tara is a famous a goddess deity. There's a vast literature on her. Okay. All righty here. Okay, from Eric. I have a question regarding the red lotus visualization in the throat performed prior to the final REM period of the night. So that suggests that you're getting up and doing it. Okay. I often don't recommend that, Eric. I recommend just doing the red lotus visualization. And for those of you who are new to this, unfortunately, I can't explain every reason like why you do this. So this is specifically to Eric. I generally don't recommend doing these things reiterated throughout the night. So if you have four REM periods and you're doing it to the final REM period, I'm not sure where you got that instruction. If it speaks to you, great. I don't generally recommend that. I generally recommend using the red lotus at the very first, before you go to sleep at night, as part of Eastern sleep hygiene, lucid sleep onset practice. I generally don't recommend doing it prior to the final REM period of the night. And first of all, how do you know that it is? Are you setting an alarm? Do you have a sleep study with sleep architecture that tells you all that? So just a little statement there. Following several minutes of waking, I lay down and begin the visualization, which is great, and hold it for a few minutes, but notice that my ability to maintain the visualization drops as I become drowsy, of course. Otherwise, you wouldn't fall asleep. That's the whole point. And I intuitively go more into an open awareness at that point. Eric, that's what I would do. I wouldn't do this at the final REM period. I would do open awareness. I would just basically, you know, maybe recite Om Adithara, which is the mantra associated with that. And then don't get too focused with it, because otherwise, in my estimation, it could actually interfere with your descent back into sleep. I have some degree of success with noticing I'm dreaming during the dream. High five. With the way I'm approaching this practice, there's all kinds of parenthetical interjections here I don't need to read. Would you recommend striving to maintain a visualization? No, I wouldn't. Or simply continue as I am. If you mean continuing as you are by doing open awareness, yes, I would say that. Unless someone has given you guidance to do the lotus visualization that late in the REM, you know, in your sleep period, I wouldn't recommend that either. That's just me. I believe I recall Tenzin Wangyal Rinpoche mentioning in an article that you may drop the visualization when you get drowsy. Yes, for sure, because otherwise you won't fall asleep. But don't have the article on hand. So Eric, I hope that's helpful. Let me scroll back up here. I'm trying to be crisp just because there are so many really great questions and I want to get to them all. Okay, here's an interesting one from Patrick. Is there a word in Buddhism for feeling someone else's gaze or attention even when you have your back completely turned to them? Yeah, it's called paranoia. Just kidding. Yeah, it's a type of, panoramic paranormal awareness. Do they have a specific term for it? Relative city, perhaps? I don't know a particular term specifically for this. You know, Rupert Sheldrake has written about this in a really interesting way. I don't know if you know his work, but he's a really kind of amazing guy. He has the moniker, the world's most controversial scientist. I love this guy. We posted a conversation, a TED talk that was banned. I had lunch with him in May in London. He's amazing. He's written about this. I recommend you check his work out. Bartending years ago, I realized this was a real thing. Oh, absolutely, positively. You know, just because our eyes are focused in this direction, it's not at all uncommon for people, once they're a little bit open and sensitized, to be aware of gazes from other entities and whatnot, because, you know, mind isn't limited just to what happens with the sensory faculties. We have these extrasensory perception capabilities, right? This is not at all unusual. Can you riff on this phenomena? Yeah, I mean, it has to do like all paranormal phenomena. And I think that's a slight misnomer. I think this limited, constricted, myopic waking state, that's paranormal. I think these are glimpses of more normal states. These are just byproducts. These so-called psychic experiences are just byproducts of openness. When you become more open and sensitive and your boundaries break down, this is the domain where shamans live, empath psychics, this mystics, this is just the way they roll. And so we all have this capacity. It's just a matter of opening. As we open, then these seemingly paranormal phenomena become actually quite normal. Another great riff on this is there's this massive 3-volume set on these kind of paranormal events, Consciousness Unbound, Irreducible Mind, and Beyond Physicalism. Probably 2,000 pages of stuff on this kind of thing. If you're really into it, check that stuff out. Back to you. While giving his attention to a leaf, wonderful. Wonderful. Thich Nhat Hanh, who I adore, writes, quote, "I spent a long time with it, the leaf, and I asked the leaf a lot of questions." Beautiful. Good for him. "I found out the leaf had been a mother to the tree." I love this stuff. I mean, what do you say? Do you relate to this metaphorically? Is this hyperbole? Is it literal? Is it mythopoetic? I don't know. I just find this actually quite beautiful. Back to you. Is it possible for monks or deeply spiritual people to communicate with trees, plants, or even non-living things like rocks, dead leaves, mountains, or planets? Yeah, why not? Why not? The world is not made of matter, right? Patrick, the world is not made of matter. The world is made of mind, heart, mind, spirit. And so the animistic traditions, the shamanistic traditions, they roll in this magical, mystical world. Now, I'm not really espousing these sorts of things, saying that spirits are locked in these rocks and trees and whatnot. But can I dismiss the fact that there's the capacity to relate and communicate to nature in this way? Not at all. I mean, I would much rather open my mind and heart to the magic and wonder and mystery of the world and the ability to communicate in these fantastic ways than shutting it down in this Western, again, nearsighted, myopic, scientific reductionist way. Don't reduce your land. Don't reduce your world to a materialistic flatland. Open it. Make yourself available. You know, the world becomes your teacher in this regard. Symbolic guru. Anything can become your teacher. As Milarepa is saying, phenomena or all the books one needs. I have heard the other spiritual traditions mention similar things, for sure, because they're describing certain realities, right? Is it possible to plant bindus, mind pearls, like seeds outside the body, or are they trapped? Oh, this is a huge issue. The whole bindu thing, generally, no. Bindus don't work that way. This is a multivalent term. Tiglay, getting into this just opens, I wouldn't say a can of worms, but it just opens a massive topic. But in terms of running around planting bindus, it doesn't really work that way. Are they trapped? What do you mean trapped? Are they trapped inside your body? It depends on how you define the term bindu. It has many, many different definitions. Quote, I wondered if this is what happens sometimes when we do prospective memory training. I don't think so. Do we leave a bindu under the doorway to remind us when we walk under that doorway to do a reality check? I love your languaging here, Patrick, but I don't think so. Wonderful creative thinking there at the end there, my friend. But as my friend Bob Thurman, I did a week with Bob Thurman this week. I just came back and I went on a little riff like this and Bob listened. This guy's amazing. He listened. We're really dear, dear friends. And he turned over to me and he said, nice try. Basically, his nice way of saying, I don't think so, Andrew. But he was very playful. He goes, nice attempt, nice try. So nice attempt at the end there, Patrick, but I don't think so. The rest of it, opening to the magic of the world? Heck yeah, why not? Okay, from Joe. What do Dharmapalas do? Dharmapalas are Dharma protectors. Oh, if you look here, maybe you can see it. Right there. Can you see this Tanka? Right there. That's the Dharmapala. Mahakala and Mahakali. I can't focus in. But the Dharmapalas are Dharma protectors. As opposed to Chetrapalas, you know, there are many different types of protectors. But Dharma protectors are the highest. What do they protect us from? Deception. Fake news. Let me just finish the question. This is a good one, and then I'll say a couple things. Do they protect our physical existence? Sometimes, maybe. Will they be of help in the bardo? Absolutely, positively. So here's a cool thing. I wondered about this myself, and I think I asked Trungpa Rinpoche this question, because, you know, prior to the invasion of Tibet by the Chinese, the Tibetans just... they knew they were going to be invaded, and every single monastery, you know, 6,000 of which were completely destroyed by the Chinese, only a few are left standing. They destroyed everything. And they knew they were about to be invaded, and they just started doing protector practice like crazy. And I asked Rinpoche, I said, okay, Rinpoche, well, wait a second here. Here they are doing these Dharma protector things, and yet every monastery has been destroyed. And, you know, paraphrasing, I said, what's the deal? What's that about? And he said, well, look at where the Dharma is today. The Dharma, because of the diaspora, because of the invasion, is actually propagated around the world. So the Dharma was protected. The monasteries may have been destroyed, but not only was the Dharma protected, but it propagated. It spread throughout the world. And so here's the thing with these Dharmapalas. You know, when you establish a relationship to them, and if you're a deep student, you take refuge in them. If you're a tantrika, you take refuge in the Dharmapalas and Dakinis. That's a second degree of refuge than what you do when you take refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha. So you take refuge in the Dharmapalas. But here's the deal with these entities, these agents, is they do not protect your comfort plan. If you think you're going to start reciting Dharmapala protector chants and whatnot, and you think you're going to win the lottery and get your car and your mate and whatever, I mean, forget it. No way. They do not protect your comfort plan. They protect truth. And if you are skidding off the truth, that energetic can come in with some force and kind of direct you somewhat wrathfully back on track. So Dharmapalas are a big deal practice in the tantric world. If you're not a tantrika, a sadhaka, you don't do Vajrayana tantra stuff, don't worry about this. But Joe, I guess you are. And if you are, check with your teacher, find out which ones they're doing and why. if you establish a relationship with them, it's one of the most powerful things you can do. But realize what you're doing when you sign on the dotted line in this contract. Make sure you bring your Dharma attorney, because then read all the appendices and the subtle asterisks and all the subtle clauses here. Because if you think they're just going to make your life nice and cozy, forget it. They protect the truth. They're not going to protect your comfort plan. They're not going to protect your, you know, you meaning anybody, your fake news strategies, your self-deception. They're going to slap you around. So they're a form of Dharma tough love. And they're fantastically efficacious, powerful. If you're a tantrika, if you're not, don't worry about this stuff. Okay, great question, Joe. And she has a couple more, or at least one more. This one's pretty straightforward. From Joe again, I'm confused about the terms ground and groundless. Okay. In some texts, it refers to obtaining qualities of the ground, the path and the fruition. And in others, that when we die, there is no ground. Okay, so this is pretty straightforward. Same signifier, different signified. In other words, it's a multivalent term, ground and groundless, same word being used in reference to different things. So that's where the confusion comes from. Same word, different referent. So are there two grounds? Well, there's more than two grounds. I mean, in this case, for sure, specifically, I'll address it. But the same term is being used in completely different contexts. And that's the conflation is where the confusion is coming from. So when you're talking about ground, path, and fruition, you're talking about the ground of the spiritual path being Buddha nature, the path being unfolding that, the fruition actually being the full actualization of the ground. When you're talking about groundless, that's a whole different thing. I guess you could make some stretches and say, well, isn't Buddha nature groundless? Yes. But the word is being used in a different way. So groundless here basically refers to emptiness, refers to the open, spacious nature of reality. That's what groundless means. So it's basically same word, different referent. When one is alive, and are there two different grounds? Yes, in this regard. When one is alive and when we are in the Bardo, what is the ground versus groundlessness? Is it a matter of translation being different? No, it's not a matter of translation. It's a matter of different signified and signifiers. Okay? Hopefully that helps. Okay, let me just see what we have here. I have to go to a different document to get these other ones. Stay with me. Okay, from Jay. This is great. We got so many questions. I think we probably might have missed it 2 weeks ago. I don't recall. Okay, what is your best hypothesis on why Tibetan Buddhism is the only dharmic path that includes dream yoga? It's not. The Bunpos do it. The Sufis do it. I have an Islamic scholar who reached out to me to share with me Islamic texts that have dream yoga. And Jewish mysticism has it. It's not just Tibetans. It's just that Tibetans probably have the most, like with the Bardo literature, arguably have the most replete riffing on this, but they are absolutely not the only one. I couldn't find anything in other Buddhist schools of the Vedantic path. Well, look at the Mandukya Upanishad. You will find the first instantiation of using dreams there. You won't find an overt dream yoga, but it's included covertly. Look at Nandua Shaiva Tantra, Kashmir Shaivism. So it's there in other traditions, Jay. It's just the Tibetans seem to have the most, at least published, translated literature here. But one of the cool things with me publishing this stuff is people reach out to me and say, oh my God, Jewish mysticism, same thing. Dream yoga takes place in Jewish mysticism at the throat. It's so awesome. I can't say with complete authority, but I would not be surprised if a number of other world wisdom traditions also have this stuff behind the scenes. Tibetan Buddhism is not the only one, for sure. Okay, from James, regarding dream journaling, if I don't have the best penmanship, you must be like me. Can I do a voice memo instead to achieve the same result? Absolutely, you can. Yes. The only slight issue with voice memo for some people is it can sometimes pull you up and out of the dream state to such an extent that it's hard to fall back asleep. But you definitely do not have to do it by writing it down. You can do voice memo for sure. And sometimes what I do when I'm just plain too lazy is I will just lie down in bed and I'll just go through the dream 1, 2, 3, 4 times, you know, kind of burning it into my memory. So then when I wake up, I don't forget it. So you can definitely do a voice memo if that works for you. Absolutely, positively. Okay, a couple more. All right, I already got that one. Got that one. This is great. These are great questions, guys. Oh, from Carol, a slightly longer one. Hi, Andrew. I've been reading, listening, immersing your books and also your Bardo teachings through Embodied Philosophy. I did some work with them. I love those people. Jacob and Stephanie, their magazine Tarka is great. I think I've done 2 courses of Embodied Philosophy. I'm doing something with them. Gosh, I almost forgot. Sometime in October. They're terrific. I've been focusing on paying attention to how much non-lucidity us here. So there's a typo. I don't know what this means. There's a typo here. Experimenting with your suggestions for lucid dreaming and meditating. Okay. I really love the tantric lap of the mother meditation. So this is a reference to the union of the mother and child luminosity in the Bardo literature. So I'm just running some commentaries. I go through it because this is the long one. I've had glimpses of apperception as the non-duality of emptiness form. Yeah, apperception is when a new perception is situated with a previous context to derive meaning to it, as well as the terror that arises when the habituated sense of self returns to reify that sense of free fall and complete lack of bearings, like a wily coyote suspended in midair after having run off the cliff. That's a great image. That is a really beautiful image. And just a comment here, Carol, the terror does not have to be there. But until we become habituated, like Wile E. Coyote isn't, to flying in space, until we are able to mix our minds with space, then that sense of, as you place it, terror, panic, is always going to be there because there's no room for personal identity in that space. That's where the terror comes from. And it's actually the very panic, fear, terror that contracts you away from that space onto a seeming sense of self, which doesn't exist. The sense of self is actually created by the contraction of the terror. And so then that terror, panic, fear becomes literally embodied as the relative self sense. So this is a profoundly revelatory experience. This is what's going to happen when we die. You're not just going to fall off a cliff. You're going to fall off, you know, your body is going to be pulled out from under you, just like Wile E. Coyote suspended in midair. And unless we're comfortable like a sky dancer or a Dakini to flying in space, we're going to panic. And that panic is going to basically hurl us back into form. Okay, back to you. I'd like to address the fear of being stuck in small spaces in my non-lucid dreams, which evokes terror and panic, which wakes me up in serious resistance to it. I would think that being lucid enough to work with this could not only help make the phobia cease, but also in the Bardo becoming. 100%. 100% agree. If your lucidity is strong enough, it will overpower. It's like Dharma. Dharma can overpower awareness. Light can overpower darkness. And so if you have lucidity, it can transform, erase all these phobias. But there are other ways to work with it. And this is, I think, where you're going. Do you think it's necessary to incorporate conventional Western therapy? I think it's super helpful. Why not? I mean, why not employ both methodologies? Dream yoga is not that interested in therapeutic approaches. It transcends therapy in the same way that daytime meditation transcends daytime therapy. In daytime meditation, you're not at all interested in content. You could care less about content. In daytime therapy, content is everything. Same thing with dream yoga. Dream yoga is not interested in content. It's interested in transforming the content. So I would approach both. Western conventional therapy can help you unearth why you may have this terror. And then the lucid dreaming can help you transcend it at an even deeper level. So I would use a full spectrum approach and I would engage in both methodologies, right? Okay, so do you think it's necessary to incorporate conventional Western therapy? I wouldn't say it's necessary, but I'd say it's super helpful. Or would getting to the root of this fear with lucid dreaming, sleep yoga be sufficient? Yes, if you can do it, it is sufficient. It actually transcends the more conventional therapeutic approach. But why not use both? I would use both. Okay. So I know I'm going rather quickly through these just to get through them and allow opportunities for live questions. And so if anybody listening has questions, comments, more than welcome. Let me see if I left anything out here. I think I did. So hang tight. I think there's one more. Oh yeah, here's another long one. Okay, hold on, and then we open it up. There's so many here. I just want to make sure I'm not missing. Okay, so here's one from Marie. I think I met you at Menla, right? Okay, is there something in reverse meditation or in preparation for Bardo training that deals with cutting through root of anger? For sure. When I'm in a place of openness, I notice when I'm not in that space. Yes, that's what open awareness is for, to create a contrast medium that allows you to better see things exactly like this. Then the anger is gone. Okay, cool. I also use the techniques from reverse meditation, which are effective for the immediate moment, for the immediate moment arising of anger. Wonderful. However, even with anger not being in the space of openness, it still arises at different times. Yes, it will, until we're Buddhas, right? Until we become fully awakened, this reification. This is interesting, a brief sidebar. Anger is extremely common, especially around death and dying, because it's an incredibly reifying emotion. It's one of the most reconstituting emotions that there is. And so when people are dying and they're losing it, one of the ways they attempt to get it together unconsciously is anger. They get angry at their caretakers. This is why it's helpful for you to know this. They get angry at their loved ones. Don't take it personally. Anger reifies the past. Fear reifies the future. Passion reifies the present. These are three principal reifying emotions. And so anger is a big deal. We're going to have it until we become pretty darned awake. Okay. Yeah, so when it arises at different times, I can see the root of the anger, feel it, taste it. Do you have any tips on how I can work on cutting down the root? I want it gone. It has been there a long time. Okay. Well, you know, a couple of things here, Marie. There's a number of ways to deal with anger, right? In my book, again, Shameless Self-Promotion, in my first book, Power and Pain, I have a chapter on the four arts of transforming emotion. Art being an acronym, arts. Abandon it, remedy it, transform it, self-liberate it. These are four classic approaches, each one associated with the yanas, the vehicles, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Sahajayana, respectively, where you can work with cutting, dealing with anger, transforming it, getting rid of it at these four different levels. If you want to get rid of it, then you can use something like the abandonment approach. But honestly, what I would do if I were you is transform it. This is, you know, transform anger into its near friend, which is clarity, precision, incisiveness, intellect. Anger in itself is not a problem. The energy of anger is actually Vajra family, Akshobhya. This is a clear, incisive quality of mind. Personally, I wouldn't get rid of it. I would transform it. If you want to get rid of it, then yes, you can use a whole battery of techniques, some of which I talk about in that arts chapter, the four arts of transforming emotions, and obviously in the reverse meditation book. I would transform it. Part two of the question, can I lose the openness? Yes, absolutely, positively. Again, until you're a Buddha, you're going to lose it because we're not the opened ones like the Buddhas are. We're the contracted ones. And so until we're familiar and stabilized in openness / emptiness, we are going to lose it. The state has not been converted into a trait. Okay, it is like nothing I have ever experienced before. I guess that means the openness. Yes, I guess it does. At times, it's like free-falling. Yes, it is. Remember Trungpa Rinpoche's famous line? Bad news is you're falling through space without a parachute. Good news is there is no ground. So you're always in free-fall. That's what it means to say that the world is empty. Don't be afraid of falling. Become a sky dancer. Become a dakini, chondro, literally. Learn how to dance in space. Be a sky dancer. Most of us fall and we freak. We panic. We're afraid of space. Back to you. At times, it's expansion beyond anything I've ever known. High five. I want to give you a hug. That's beautiful. And yet, I can keep going with whatever I'm doing. Beautiful. It's such a gift. So I have a fear that I will lose it. Can that happen? Of course. We always have a fear of losing it. That's samsara. So what you do is you let it come, you let it go. Don't be afraid of losing anything. Be able to ride in the practice of open awareness. That's one of the practices of open awareness, right? Is to allow whatever to arise, let it come, let it go. And then fundamentally, that will allow you to transcend your fear of losing anything. And then when you have that type of openness, right? Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Don't worry about losing it. You're going to lose everything but your mind, your awareness. So there was another thing. You had another question here to clarify. To clarify the question on anger, and then I'm done with all the written questions. The reason I want to get rid of the root, I just saw it, which means I guess you just saw why you wanted to get rid of it. Is that what that means? It takes my mind away from other people and their concerns. Absolutely. Because neurotic anger is highly reifying, contracting. It blinds you to other people, for sure. Takes me away from being in prayer for them. Yes. Of helping them. Yes. I put myself in the state of me, me, me. Absolutely. Highly self-referential, which is what neurotic anger is about. It is then that the separation state of me and them, I construct that. It is my doing. Yes, it is your doing. But how do I deconstruct it at its root? Well, again, just to reinstate, you can do that a number of different ways depending on what particular set of teachings you have a connection to. The highest level of liberation is Sahajayana, the vehicle of self-liberation. This is Jogchen Mahamudra, where your mind is so open, so sensitized, so awake. When that energy that would blossom into anger first arises, your mind is so open, so sensitive, you see it at its root. You see it before it ever takes birth, so to speak. And that's the highest level. And then from there, you kind of cascade down, quote unquote, to the tantric levels, then to the Mahayana levels, and then to the Hinayana levels. Okay, so sorry, I kicked through those rather quickly and it still took me 46 minutes. Well, that's cool. So I will now open it up to people that are here. We have a couple of Domenica and Marianne, and then I'll get some of the questions that are in the chat column. So go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hi.
Hi.
So your question that you love to ask all different teachers, if you found out you only had a few minutes left to live, what would be the irreducible expression of your teaching? Do you recall if you ever asked that question of Kenpo Karta Rinpoche? And if so, do you remember his reply?
Oh boy, I don't remember if I asked him that question. I interviewed him. Last time I saw him was I was interviewing him for my Preparing to Die book. So to the best of my fading memory, I do not believe I had the opportunity to ask him that question. That's something I'd have to really mull on to see if something pops up, but off the top of my head, I don't remember. And the reason I say that is because I almost always remember the answers that I'm given. So I don't recall. So which means I probably didn't ask him. Missed opportunity.
Well, if it comes to you in the middle of the night, save it for me.
Okay. Are you a student of his, or were you?
Well, now only in the ether, but yes, for many years.
Yeah, he's a rock star. I mean, yeah. His teachings on Mahamudra, I mean, the 10-day teachings, you know, he gave a 5-year series on the Nathan Jamso, the best teachings on Mahamudra I've ever come across. So I'm a huge fan of his. He was best buds with Trungpa Rinpoche. And so he'd often come down to Crestone to hang out with Trungpa Rinpoche. And that's where I got a chance a little bit to see him. But I didn't hear him teach in person a lot. I mean, he was mostly at KTD. I'm out here in Colorado. So I didn't have a lot of opportunities until I actually flew out, set up an appointment, and had this interview for my book. But outside of that, yeah, if something comes to mind, I'll note to self, I will tell you next time I see you. Okay? Yeah. Good for you for studying and stuff. This guy's a rock star. I love him. He's just the best. So cool. Okay, Marianne, far away, dear.
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, nice to see you. So Marianne, she runs our dream sharing group every other Saturday. And remind me, are we doing that this Saturday or not? I can't remember.
No, we had it last Saturday, and there's five Saturdays in September. So not again until the first week of October.
Okay, cool. All right.
After that, I'm going to meander my way back to the Texas Hill Country for a good part of the fall. Oh. And where I have my tiny homes. Yeah, I have my tiny homes, and I have awesome lucid dreams sometimes when I'm there. My question is, while I'm there, one of the projects I'm considering is digging my own grave.
Perfect. Highly recommended. No kidding. Yeah.
And I wanted to get your thoughts about green burials versus cremation.
Sure. Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, on the burying yourself thing, I mean, it may seem kind of twisted, but it's actually a really great thing to do. I mean, they're Christian mystics who you know, as part of their tradition, they literally dug their graves before they died. I know some teachers who work very skillfully in programs where people do that. I haven't done that, but maybe I should consider it. Where people dig, they dig the little graves, you know, and they're able to keep their head above the dirt, and there's a person at their side the whole time, and they get to hang out, so to speak, or hang down in this space. So, I mean, cool for you. In terms of green burial versus cremation, you know, this is such an individual, personalized thing, right? I have a dear friend, Karen Van Buren, who has natural, what's it called? Space senior moment. Just down the road, she has a whole green burial thing where they do water cremations, they do litter cremations, and then they do this green burial thing. And so, you know, it's really kind of up to you. There's also, parenthetically, I can't remember the name of this. There's a really quirky TED talk by this gal. If you look it up, she has this like bacterial fungus suit that she's created that is generated based on your particular biome, and that it's pretty trippy. It's worth watching. And she's actually giving a talk with this thing on, and basically it's designed to work with help biodegrading her thing. So, you know, I'm not sure what to say here, Mary. It really depends on one's personal predispositions and how much of a footprint they want to leave behind. I actually kind of like the idea of the water burial, the water cremation, where you just get, you know, you rock back and forth in the solvent for like 4 hours, and then you take that solution and you pour it on the plants and in the gardens and stuff. I kind of relate to that. So I'm not sure what to say. I can put you on contact with these people in Louisville that have this place, and you can get some consultation from them. In fact, I was going to try to bring one of them on for our Preparing to Die program. So I'm not sure what else to say on that. I'm curious why you bring it up.
I just wanted to get your thoughts on it. I'm feeling really good about it. For many, many years, I just assumed I would be cremated, and now I've changed my mind to a green burial. And you know, I'm fortunate enough to have land where I can do that, where I can dig my own grave. And I wanted to have it, you know, prepared so I wouldn't burden my family with it. I want to have it all taken care of. But well, I was just curious.
Yeah, that's the most important thing, right? It's a form of POA, right? To get all this stuff done, mm-hmm. Make it as easy as possible for those left behind. But outside of that, I mean, it really, I tend to reserve comments and judgments. It's not even judgments, just comments, because it's so idiosyncratic. But personally,
I was just wondering, in the Tibetan tradition, I thought cremation was kind of advocated, but maybe I'm wrong about
not
that.
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, sky burial. You go to Tibet, there's not enough wood to cremate. The ground is hard to dig. So they feed you to the vultures, right? So I don't think you can do that in the U.S. yet. I mean, not that I'm aware of. So, yeah, it really, Hindu tradition, they prefer the cremation thing. Buddhist, again, it depends on where you are. So on those sorts of topics, I tend, just like I mentioned, to just be a little bit more reserved and let people just go with what they feel is appropriate for them. Sorry. Good to see you, dear.
Thank you, Andrew. Nice to see you, too.
Yeah. Hey, Lynn. Fire away.
Hey, in relation to the green burial thing, I just wanted to mention there's another option now that's legal in Washington State and Colorado and a couple of other places. It's casually referred to as human composting. I think the legal name is natural organic reduction. And they put the body in a sealed vessel with some organic material, and 6 to 8 weeks later, except for implants like fillings or body, you know, hip replacements, things like that. Everything's dirt.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and then so people can, I'm sure if people Googled human composting, you'd find that.
Yeah,
and then you can
option.
Nourish a tree or tomato plants.
Absolutely.
Or whatever.
Exactly. You know, the Sanskrit just have a nice phrase here, panchatvam gata, which means return to fiveness. That's one way they talk about death, return to fiveness, which means you're returning your five elements to their primordial lender, which is Mother Earth.
Yeah.
And so that really speaks to me. I mean, cool in a kind of gallows death kind of way, but this is the stuff that we all should be considering, putting it in our advanced directives and having our executors and people actually do this for us. So it's definitely worth bringing to the table and talking about. So thank you for that contribution, Lynn. That's great. Nice to see you as well. So there are a couple of things here in the column from Deanna. Hello, will you offer an in-person dream retreat at Drala Center next year? No. The only thing I do at Drala Center is my death and dying series. And next year is going to be year 5. They're all standalones. But next year is going to be on, interestingly, it's always the most popular one, Sutra and Tantra Pure Land. So a full week at Drala Mountain Center, either in May or August, might be in May. We don't have a date yet on Pure Lands. The only dream thing I'm doing in the States is the Bayo thing that I do outside of Aspen. So I will do that again. It's my annual thing. That's in June. And then I'm doing a week long in Costa Rica. We just nailed it at this beautiful place, which I have not taught at before, called Blue Spirit. So I'll be doing a week long introductory thing on lucid dreaming there, then a little bit more advanced thing at Bayo. None of that's on the books yet, but thank you for asking and thanks for your interest. From James, in what ways does dream yoga align with Judd Brewer's Unwinding Anxiety program? I can't answer that, even though I know Judson. I like the guy a lot. I interviewed him. Really bright guy, really cool guy. And I know he's done some amazing things with his apps. I don't know enough to address this question. So I'm going to have to pass on that, unfortunately. But I'm a big fan of his work. The guy's amazing. He's one of these contemplative scientists, neuroscientists that's just doing amazing work. MD, PhD, really cool guy. How do you spell controversial? Rupert Sheldrake, Sheldrake. Yep, Rupert Sheldrake. He's really cool. Yeah, Dharmapala, that's been spelled properly. Thank you for that. Thanks for helping people. There's a company here along with Jewish and Islamic mystics doing dream yoga. The Toltec tribes of Central America did it too. Very cool. Robert Moss and active dreaming. Yes. Yep. Yep. Totally. Yep. There's a lot out there. Very cool. Four arts. Yes, sorry, I went through those rather quickly. So A is abandon it. That's a Theravada approach. R is remedy it. That's a Mahayana approach, like the Lojong slogans. T is transform it. That's a tantric approach. S is sahaja yana. That's self-liberation approach. Okay. Okay. All right. I think, buzzer shot by Dr. J. Fire away, Dr. J, and then I think we're done for today.
We have one more that came in through the chat, too. She just can't unmute.
Oh, okay. And so, here it is. Is it the one on donating anyone's body?
No, it's Meredith. She wanted to raise her hand, but she's on her cell phone and can't do it. So.
Hi, Andrew.
Donating one's body to a forensic body farm where its breakdown outdoors is observed. Yeah. Again, that's up to you. I know of these places. I personally don't have any thoughts on that really. If you think it's a beneficial thing to do, why not? I personally don't have anything to say about that, a little bit like the cremation thing. So no real comment on that. If it works for you and you feel it's a wonderful thing to do, then yeah, go for it. Okay, Dr. J, last one, unless Alyssa has another one for me. We're finished.
Hi, Andrew.
Gary?
Well, as you mentioned earlier in the program, the communists invaded Tibet, I think, in 1959, and you said they destroyed like 5,000 to 6,000 monasteries.
6,000.
6,000 monasteries, yeah. And so the question I have is, and there's also, of course, in the same region, Nepal and Bhutan. What's the status of Buddhism now in Tibet?
Oh, geez. It depends on where you go. I can't speak with real authority here, Jerry. I haven't been there recently. It's been a while. And I don't know people who are like rolling in the whole Tibetan thing. I think in the monasteries that are being rebuilt, you know, outside of Lhasa and whatnot, to a certain extent, they're at least still there. You know, how free they are to do what they originally did, I have no idea on that. My guess is they're probably chock full of Chinese spies, because when I was there, we were warned not to say anything about the Dalai Lama. That can get you thrown in jail, no pictures, because the monks there, you can never tell who was a monk and who was a Chinese spy. So I can't speak with any real authority on this. That's a trickier question above my pay grade for now. But monasteries do seem to be there. To what extent they're doing lip service and whatnot to the Dharma, I really just don't know. Bhutan's a different story. It's thriving there. It's the last kind of Vajrayana kingdom on the planet, so it's doing exceptionally well in Bhutan. I think Tibet is a different story, and probably a pretty challenging kind of deal.
And so, anything about Nepal?
Nepal's fine. I mean, that's a place I go to, at least I used to go to every year. It's doing great in Nepal. I mean, it's thriving there. I mean, it's one of the areas where the diaspora, where Tibetans landed in mass. And so it's thriving in Nepal for sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right, everybody. Nice to see you. So great to be back. Hopefully I'll be back in 2 weeks. I've got some traveling things coming up. I'll do my best to be around. Otherwise, great to see everybody. Great, wonderful questions. Always nice to hang. And to whatever extent dedication and merit may mean something to you, you know, whatever we've done of any value, we send out to the world, because I always say this every single time I do anything. If what we're doing here is not of benefit to others and to the planet, it's irrelevant. So always remember that we're doing this to help others and to help the world. Don't forget that. Until then, everybody, nice to see you all. Take care. See you around the block.